You are listening to the new British broadcasting station, operating on 5,925 kilocycles and on a wavelength of 50.63 meters. You will hear us again at 10:30 p.m. tomorrow. It is doubtful whether a major war leaves the social conditions of a country entirely unchanged, and it very often happens that war reveals many of the uglier features of a nation's social character. So it is with this war. It is very probable that our politicians expected the excitement of hostilities to obscure the grievances of ordinary people, to whom the mere sustenance of life itself was a problem. With certain exceptions, press has lent itself to this intention, and certainly the BBC has been used most assiduously for the purpose. Nevertheless, the whole stirring of the government's propaganda machine is unable to suppress the complaints and grievances which are increasing each day in number. The reason is that the masses of the people have never had any real heart in the war since it began. If they could have been marched into it with bands playing, drums beating, and balloons going up, if they could have been presented with some genuine and striking victory every day, they might have felt otherwise. But nothing of the sort has happened, and the extremely shifty attitude of the Admiralty in imparting information has tended to discredit all news emanating from government sources. In consequence, the German radio has gained a success and a popularity far beyond the real merits of its transmissions. It is extremely provoking for any decent Englishman to think that our own social injustices have to be brought to light by hostile wireless stations. And it is partly for this reason that we have founded the new British broadcasting station. In future, it will not be possible for the enemy to say that nobody of the people in Britain has the courage or the energy to fight against the evils which the British people have to suffer.
An old English proverb is, early to bed and early to rise makes the men healthy, wealthy, and wise. Now here's what the average Englishman thinks of the present system of getting healthy, wealthy, and wise. No more whiskey if you're blue. No more steaks and onions too. What to do about it? Let's put on the lights and go to sleep. No more money in the banks. The Russians get our guns and tanks. What's to do about it? Let's put out the lights and go to sleep. The food gets dearer every day, and the shops are closing. Mr. Gloom is on his way, and the Russians losing. No more butter, eggs and cheese. No more tea and coffee, please. What's to do about it? Let's put out the lights and go to sleep. Here is the anthem of the International Brotherhood of Bolsheviks.
We fight for the left with murder and with theft. To fight for the right would not be right. Our land is bella, bella. It will soon be the world, because in London and in New York the red flags unfurled. We sing Nietzsche woe, so that you may know that life in our world is Nietzscheable.
permit himself to utter such asinine claims, so obviously contradicted by facts, is not intelligible, except on the assumption that a public foolish enough to tolerate the dictatorship of Churchill is foolish enough to stand anything. We have long recognized the fact that the British people have been deceived. But is it not a slightly novel experience to see them being treated as congenital imbeciles who are psychologically incapable of disbelieving or even doubting any statement, however ridiculous, made by a minister of the crown? Before the war, National Socialist Germany was often accused of having regimented opinion. The spirit of voluntary sacrifice which characterizes the war effort of the German people has shown this charge to be false. But it is certainly not unfair to say that Churchill and his confederates are acting on the assumption that the opinion of the British people is a lower biological process than the most elementary agitation in the lowest form of protoplasmic organism. How far this assumption may be correct remains to be seen. As the bloody and battered fragments of what was once the British Expeditionary Force drift back in wreckage to the shores of England, it is not impossible that the public will turn savagely upon the men who have so cruelly and unscrupulously deceived it. At any rate, the bitterest disillusionment will now blend with the fear of invasion, which has, not unreasonably, been growing stronger every day. It is not little amusing to think of the trumpetings and flourishings with which Churchill became Prime Minister of Britain. He was the man to frighten Hitler. He was the providential leader who was going to lead Britain to victory. Look at him today, unclean and miserable figure that he is. And contrast his contemptible appearance with the bright hopes that his propagandists aroused in the minds of people foolish enough to believe that this darling of Jewish finance could really set the might of National Socialist Germany at naught. The old world is tumbling about the ears of the reactionaries who sought to destroy the new. When Germany declared herself independent of their caprice and threw off the shackles of gold, they resolved upon her destruction. But thanks to God and the Führer, it is not Germany that is confronted with destruction today.
Germany calling, Germany calling. Here are the Reichswender ambush, station Bremen and station DXB on the 31-meter band.
Welcome to Radio Albion, Toilet Over England, Chapter 5, by William Joyce. You first heard Charlie and his orchestra, also referred to as the Templin Band, and Bruno and his Swinging Tigers. They were a Nazi-sponsored German propaganda swing band. Jazz music styles were seen by Nazi authorities as rebellious, but ironically, Propaganda Minister Joseph Goebbels conceived of using the style in shortwave radio broadcasts aimed at the United States, and particularly the United Kingdom. British listeners heard the band every Wednesday and Saturday at about 9 p.m. The importance of the band in the propaganda war was underscored by a BBC survey released after World War II, which indicated that 26.5% of all British listeners had at some point heard programmes from Germany. The propaganda ministry also distributed their music on 78 RPM records to prisoner of war camps and occupied countries. The purpose of the band were to encourage pro-Nazi sympathies, draw attention to World War II Allied losses, convince listeners that Great Britain was a pawn for America and Jewish interests, and convey German dictator Adolf Hitler's message in an entertaining form. The song stressed how badly the war was going for the target audience and how it would be only a matter of time until they would be defeated. Now we'll go on to Chapter 5 of Twilight Over Germany by William Joyce. Chapter 5, Finance. In the last chapter, some account, however sketchy, was given of the deplorable economic condition into which the majority of British men and women had sunk in recent times. It must not be forgotten, however, that there was a rich and contented minority, whereas the state of the masses of the people was unworthy of any civilised nation, above all unworthy of a nation which had such resources as England. There was in the land a ruling class which was probably more prosperous than any similar class in the world. Attached to this sacred caste was an upper middle class stratum, which certainly had no good reason to complain. There were, in fact, two Englands, each ignorant of the other's existence. If 9 or 10 people were crowded into a little damp basement in Hoxton Market, there were 450 persons in Britain whose personal wealth passed the million mark. The plain fact of the matter is that Jewish law ruled in England. Those who merely produced wealth were the lowest caste. The path to splendour was the path of exchange. To make the soil yield up a few more turnips was to attract the highly suspicion attention of government servants. To sit on the fattest rump that good living could provide and wait for foreign dividends to come in was the qualification for national approval and membership of the Order of Sacred Beasts. The soundest advice that a businessman could give to his son, unless destined for the gods, would be, "Produce nothing, my boy, not even children. Buy something in the way of shares, if you can, and wait till you find some bloody fool who will pay you more than you gave for them. Also, join the craft. Above all, do nothing extraordinary. Otherwise, people won't trust your judgment." Now, it is the system of international finance that is entirely at the root of all the troubles we have described. But a treatise on finance must be either very long or very short, and this is going to be very short. There is no compromise between the barest outline and the most exhaustive, and possibly exhausting, thesis. The motto of the Oriental Market of Ancient Theories, the Lubner School of Economics, is Rerum cognoscere causas, to know the causes of things. Let us begin then with an informative quotation from the Good Old News Chronicle, never failing source of damning information. In its issue of December 12, 1938, it blandly relates, "The story of the gold fixing has often been told, how every weekday at 11 a.m. the representatives of 5 firms of bullion brokers and 1 firm of refiners meet at the offices of Messrs. Rothschild, expect on Saturday, and there fix the sterling price of gold. There is, however, a great deal of activity which lies beyond the final act. The decentralisation of the demand and the supply of gold in one office and the fixing of the price of gold on that basis. A price of gold is at first suggested, probably by the representative of Messrs. Rothschild, who also acts for the Bank of England and for the Exchange Equalisation Account. Although aid with the old equaliser, really, vulgarity apart, this little description is very rich in unconscious humour. On Saturday, of course, the crook who has to represent the Bank of England and the Treasury wraps himself in his prayer shawl and plays the Kol Nidre on his sensuous violin and lusciously meditates on the nature of his operations for the following week. It is somewhat terrifying to think that this fellow would decide the cost of living, the wages, the prices, and every other economic element in the life of the British people. The ordinary man does not even know that there is such a person, much less who he is or what he does with himself on a Saturday morning. Indeed, if you were to tell many otherwise well-informed English people that the Jews controlled finance, they would not believe you. The News Chronicle, however, is not exactly a Nazi source of information. And, whatever Britain's external relations may be, it is inevitable under the present system that the control of gold must mean the economic control of British national life. And the Treasury does not even think it worthwhile to have a representative of its own at this ritual murder which takes place every weekday except Saturday at 11 a.m. To be clear on the whole matter, we must realise that, fundamentally, there can be only two views as to the purpose of money. There must be a thousand intermediate shares of opinion, but eventually one is forced back into the position of having to decide whether money exists for man or man for money, whether money is merely a symbol of real wealth enabling commodities and services to be exchanged, or whether it is the determinant of all industry by the criterion of which production and distribution must be regulated. The former is the concept of National Socialism, the latter is the theory of liberal capitalism and international finance. Consider the commonest case of commercial absurdity found in financial democracy. It is well known that a great mass of people want far more of this world's goods than they have, far more to eat, far more clothes, let us say. But the industrialist does not produce enough. Ask him why and he will say, because if I do produce any more, the merchant will not pay me. Go then to the merchant and ask him why he does not order more goods. He will say, of course I would order them if only I could sell them. Heaven knows I want a bigger market badly enough. Then tell him that Mrs. Smith wants more bacon, Mrs. Brown more butter, Mrs. Jones more beef. In fact, recite a list of the wants of all those in the neighbourhood and ask him whether all these people could not constitute a market for him. He will reply, my dear sir, do you really think that I'm giving my stocks away? Good Lord, people are no use to me unless they have cash. Thus, within a few hundred yards of his stores, there may be thousands of people longing to form the market that he wants. They are willing to work and work hard. The raw materials and the machinery are not lacking. They lack one thing only, the money. Thus, raw materials, engineering prowess, mechanical efficiency, plentiful labour, organising ability all count for nothing because this impertinent factor, money, intervenes and cries, halt. A market consists merely of people who want to buy and have the money to effect the purchase. This fact, however, is hard to bring home to those who habitually think in terms of money, that is, the vast majority of the English today. Of course, the whole subject of the system's propaganda is to encourage the population to think in this way. So long as men and women look up to money as the supreme determinant of economic conditions, so long will they be easy to cheat. So long will they fail to analyse the contents of the gulf between consumption and production. As soon as industrialism established itself, the majority of people lost touch with the production of the primary necessities of life. A man might make screws, for example, but he could not eat them. Food he must get. Somewhere or other was a group of persons who determined how many screws went to the pound of bread. Who they were, the worker knew not. Even their locality remained a mystery to the ordinary man. Then, when the pound of bread set out on its travels, everybody who handled it took a slice so that by the time it reached the screwmaker, it had lost a certain amount of weight. Of course, bakers and carriers had to live, but apart from those honestly engaged in the making and carrying, there was a series of persons called middlemen, whose sole function was to pass the loaf from one to another and take a slice. Indeed, most of them never saw the loaf at all, but got the slice just the same. Now, the most immoral part of these transactions was not that all these useless people had their whack of the loaf, but that the poor screwmaker never knew and never had any means of knowing what exact relation prevailed between his screws and his bread. The mystery of this relationship remained in the hands of those who controlled the monetary system, or who left it uncontrolled in a knowledge that the pirates and jugglers would make the best of the financial anarchy which went by the name of individual liberty, and which meant the individual liberty of one man to rob another, if he could do it respectably. Now, these conditions were not limited in duration to the early days of the Industrial Revolution. In England, they reign supreme today. Such, moreover, is the force of the propaganda which international finance can afford to conduct, that the supposedly cultured classes in England can see nothing monstrous in the fact that every year enormous quantities of wheat are burnt and great masses of fish flung back into the sea, whilst there are 13.5 million undernourished persons on the island. If you say to them, this thing is done merely to keep prices high, they will cordially agree and smile their approval, as they think of their foreign dividends. Of course, when a ruling class can sink to this depth of moral perversion, it is not very far from its end. The notion that the level of production should be controlled by monetary considerations belongs to a very primitive and superstitious stage of social evolution. Indeed, there are few savage tribes that would accept it as it is accepted in Britain today. Suppose that in some very backward island, a shell standard of money prevailed. Assume also that some malicious or half-witted creature managed to acquire half the shells in the island and to drop them into the water beyond recovery. The chiefs and witch doctors would have to hold a council of emergency. But if the rulers of the island decreed that because half the money of the community had been lost, hunting and fishing and tilling must now be reduced by 50%, there'd be a hot time in the old town that night. In such a simple state of society, the criminal absurdity of the proposal would be obvious to the meanest and most untutored intellect. Yet a policy which the most undeveloped savage tribe would reject as nonsense has been accepted by the British people as a sacred ritual for many years. Thus, of course, international finance, by restricting supplies and causing shortage, can produce whatever conditions of marketing that may be most profitable to itself. If there is one truth against which the old school of finance is fighting today, it is the supreme verity that production of goods should be based on the needs of the people, the only limit being the limit of natural resources and raw materials. Since the dawn of human history, the great struggle of man has been to wrest from nature by force and cunning the means of life and enjoyment. It was only when the blessings of modern democracy made their appearance 150 years ago that he was told, in an arbitrary manner, that his efforts must be slackened and regulated henceforth for the private interests of an infinitesimal proportion of the world's population. 5 minutes on his thought devoted to the whole matter should be enough to clear away the myths, the obscurities and the mysteries that have been deliberately built up around the system to conceal its inherent wickedness. National Socialist Germany realised from the first day of its existence that the main problem of economics was maximal production of the commodities the population required. All questions of distribution must be contingent on the existence of something to distribute, the more the better. Once an adequate level of production is reached, it is only a matter of totalitarian administration to secure that the money system shall give the people the purchasing instruments whereby they can establish the titles to possess and enjoy what they have produced. Of course, a certain amount of the wealth produced must always be set aside to serve as the basis for further production. Hence the people can never at once consume the whole of what they have produced, but the part that they can consume will be perfectly adequate, so long as the level of production is sufficient and the proper proportion is maintained between capital goods and consumers' goods. Quite naturally, the operation of a managed currency, whereby purchasing power is equated to the people's needs, must depend upon the absolute power of the state to control all economic elements, including prices, wages, rents, dividends and profits in the service of the whole people, with no respect to class prejudice. Such a control is, of course, incompatible with the conditions of democracy. Hence the frenzied efforts of the British plutocrats to preserve this democracy, which excludes the only form of organisation that could compel the individual to respect the freedom of others as much as he respects his own. Of course, the moment Germany revolted against the conception that production should be restricted in the interests of a few high financiers, she created in the minds of all well-informed democrats the fear that Central Europe would break away altogether from the system of international finance. That fear was amply justified, but it rendered war between England and Germany inevitable, unless some hundreds of Jews were to swing in timely fashion from the lampposts of Westminster. It would have been cruel to hang them, but the consequences of not doing so will be very much more serious for the world than would a transient act of limited violence. This language may seem strong, but the casualties in this war have already far exceeded the number of persons responsible for causing it. War is both unpleasant and brutal, but the Jewish control of international finance over all these years has been infinitely more brutal than any war could be. To know that one will be shot or blown to bits is distinctly unpleasant, but any man worthy of the name would be far less dismayed by this thought if he had no dependents than by the thought that he might be unemployed for years. If he had dependents, the experience of seeing his wife sinking into tuberculosis and his children growing up with rickets should be more intolerable than the prospect of a brief agony in a world where democracy is not to be found. Of course, not one of the men who control capitalist finance today knows how it feels to wait month after month for a job that never comes, to see one's few pence disappearing, and to experience the spiritual hopelessness and the physical illness which come from the thought, "In the whole of this wide world, nobody wants me. Nobody wants my brain or my hands. I must go and beg." The well-to-do who read these lines will sneer. Their derision will receive its ample compensation in the recognition granted by those who have been unemployed in mighty England. Unfortunately, so many of the unemployed do not understand that the arbitrary restriction of production and the control of the monetary system for the benefit of the rich can never mean anything but unemployment. Lack of purchasing power in the hands of the people means lack of effective demand. Lack of effective demand means less work and more unemployment. There is another important aspect of the question. One machine today, minded by two men, can do as much work in 10 hours as 100 men could do a few decades ago. But surely the human race will not wait until 10,000 men can produce its entire needs by the aid of machinery before introducing some reasonable system of labour. When the stage is reached at which enough and more is being produced by machinery, there will be enough to distribute, and the solution of the unemployment problem will lie in shorter hours. Whether a man works 10 hours a day or 5 is immaterial so long as maximal production of needed goods is secured. What is vital is that every citizen able to work should be given the chance and thereby earn the ethical right to participate in the distribution. As a matter of fact, although Germany has raised their production in the past few years from 100% in some industries to 2,000% in others, she still finds it necessary to import labour. Indeed, that necessity existed before the present war. Work begets work. In any case, Adolf Hitler's solution of the unemployment problem was a challenge which international finance could not ignore. The success of international Jewish conspiracy, supported also by corrupt and selfish non-Jews, depended on the magnitude of its scope. More than 80 million of the most industrious and able people in the world were lifted by Hitler right out of the domain of the Hebrew system. The whole conception, moreover, of international finance is repugnant to the National Socialist. He can see no argument for investing his country's capital abroad to the detriment of home industries. It may well be that the latter yield a lower dividend. In many cases, it is desirable that they should. The fair distribution of wealth is quite incompatible with unlimited profits. But, even in an extreme case be taken, a National Socialist would prefer to draw 2% from a useful home industry rather than take 20% from a foreign concern which competes with the labour of his fellow workers. The National Socialist, conscious of race and tradition, deems it his duty to think, work and spend for his country. The German National Socialist, for example, finds it hard to understand why British financiers should have injured England's coal trade by placing their resources at the disposal of Polish coal mines in which sweated labour was employed. In general, then, the National Socialist theory is that the money which is made in a country should go to its further development and that any temporary sacrifice is justified by the ultimate benefit that it will bring to his nation. This view is so diametrically opposed to the whole thesis of international finance that there should be no difficulty in understanding why a conflict between the two could not be avoided. Whether or not the conflict was to be armed was a matter that the international financiers themselves had to decide. They did not reach the decision to employ military force until every other method of beating Germany and frustrating Hitler had been tried and exhausted. Patiently they waited for the predicted collapse of the new German economic system. It never came, because their influence was ruled out from the first day. Then when unemployment vanished and production rose by leaps and bounds, they knew that waiting was useless. Just as scores of previous wars were fought in the interests of their order, so a new war was launched. The Hebrews and their creatures had set out on the last desperate expedition to keep this world in bondage. The real masters of Britain had played their last card. With this fraternity, our next chapter deals. Okay, so that's the end of chapter 5, finance. The next chapter is the Jews. That will be up soon because I already recorded it because I forgot to do chapter 5. Again, very informative stuff from William Joyce, mentioning the Rothschilds. Clearly he understands who pulls the economic strings of England. How much of that was to do with his parting from Mosley is hard to say, but clearly with Oswald Mosley, he didn't want to go where Joyce goes in this chapter and other chapters, which is that it's the Rothschilds and the other Khazars and Jews and their helpers, Gentile helpers, that really rule England. And of course 99% of English people back then wouldn't understand that, but today, of course, with the internet and such, more and more people are understanding it. So I'll leave it there. Best take care. 14 words.